Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Porter was always in my head.
Checkerfin. Checkerfin.
Yes.
It's the education gadfly.
Sex, sex.
Mike and Rick tell you
early college, high school, pain and suffering,
learning and teaching.
In your face, in your face, in your face.
Listen to your words that baby preaching, cause here's the education gadfly show. Yeah, it's the education gadfly.
Hello, this is your host Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation. Here with my co-host, the Tiger Woods of education policy, Rick Hess.
Hey, Mike, that's very kind of you.
Well, I figure what? He has now won, 14 major tournaments?
A lot of tournaments.
And how many books, major books, have you written or edited?
Wow.
About 14,
That seems like a sad comparison. And I got to say, my knee feels just fine to boot.
That right? So now he's chasing this record set by Jack Nicklaus. So whose record are you chasing?
This is just, it gets sadder and sadder.
I'm serious, Rick. Who out there has been more prolific than you? I mean, is there anybody that you have your sights set on?
the problem with the analogy is that each of Tiger's wins actually clearly marks an accomplishment. The fact that you can get a publisher to put your words between covers doesn't necessarily mean anything of the kind.
All right. Well, wow. So humble. Okay. All right. Well, Rick, hope you're doing well today.
Why, thank you, Mike. I hope you're doing well.
As always, yes. We got a big show to cover. We're going to play Pardon the Gadfly. We are going to hear one of Jeff Kooner's last education outrages of the week. And we're going to hear some education news of the weird.
It's a lot to get through.
So, school is out. School's over, but not the Education Gadfly show. We plow ahead. So, Christina, let's get started.
Topic one. We at the Fordham Institute are out with a new report today, High Achieving Students in the Era of NCLB, available at edexcellence.net.
Shameless self-promotion.
Well, I learned from the best, right? The report's primary finding that we'll discuss today is that while low-achieving students have made some very positive gains since 2000, the high-achieving students' performance has been languid, according to Tom Lovelace. So the main question here, Mike, start us off. Can we be equal and excellent, too?
Well, thanks for asking, Christina. Well, look, I think at a policy level, theoretically, yes, we could find a way to tweak No Child Left Behind and other accountability systems to provide incentives to schools to pay attention to their high-achieving kids and not just their low-achieving kids. You look at various kinds of growth models, and we can get into all the wonkery of that. However, at a classroom level, I think it's fair to say that if a teacher's looking out, sees 25 kids, some of whom are two grade levels behind and others are two grade levels ahead, they have to make choices. And what they are telling us in a national teacher survey that was part of this study was that they're choosing to spend their time and focus on the lowest achieving students. And groups like Education Trust don't seem to want us to even have this discussion or this debate because they probably understand the parents aren't going to be happy to hear this news. But look, we should be honest about it. Say, there are trade-offs, and if we want to focus all of our energy on closing the achievement gap, that might mean that our best and brightest kids are going to be ignored.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at Steve Farkas's survey as part of your report, it's real clear that teachers say they believe that the right thing to do is to spread their time more or less evenly across the students they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. It's also clear that they have a sense that they are expected to focus their energies on the children at the lower end of the achievement distribution, and that by large numbers, 80 or 90%, they're reporting that this is where they're spending most of their time and energy.
Yeah, certainly when it comes to one-on-one attention for kids. And this is what's interesting. When we ask them, as you indicated, what do you think is more just and equitable? Is it to focus on disadvantaged kids who are behind or to spread your attention equally to all students? It's the latter, overwhelmingly, that they believe. I suspect that most Americans would say the same thing. Not that teachers aren't Americans, but there is a subset of Americans.
Just getting that foot deeper and deeper in that mouth.
Okay, moving on.
I mean, some teachers are probably Canadians, too, like Jeff Kooner. And that doesn't make them bad people.
Okay.
Win and whole?
Next. A new report from the College Board argues that the stereotype of Asian students as the model minority is a myth. Some people want to break out achievement data by subgroups of Asian ethnicities. Is this racial identity politics gone wild?
Yes. It's no more racial identity politics gone wild than the notion that any child who is a drop of black blood or African-American blood is going to be labeled black by the U.S. government for purposes of accountability systems. Once we get into this habit of counting children and evaluating schools based on the bloodlines that these children have, we get into incredibly murky and I think quite worrisome water. And how are we going to arbitrarily draw these lines? You know, as soon as you actually start to think about this kind of stuff too hard, mm-hmm. you're immediately in a world of hurt.
Yeah, and you know, and this issue gets very sensitive, of course, on college campuses. You've got some schools in California, for example, that now have a big percentage of their students who are Asian. And you know, hear these rumors about whether or not there should be some sort of quota put, just like 100 years ago when people were worried that there were too many Jewish students on college campuses, and they limited the number of Jewish students. There was an Asian student, I think, that didn't get into Princeton, who sued and claimed that he didn't get in because he was Asian, and if he was a different race, he would have gone in. And so the point the College Board seems to be making is, look, you know, Asians are not monolithic. There are plenty of Asian ethnicities that are not doing very well.
Yeah, I mean, this is true of any ethnic group. I mean, it's certainly true of African-Americans, that there's decades of research, John Agu's stuff most famously, but decades of research showing that depending on parentage and immigration patterns, there's vast differences between different subpopulations of African-Americans. The notion, I mean, if we're going to get into keeping crude scorecards based on whether we call somebody an African-American or Latino or white, mm-hmm. we're going to get into these overgeneralization problems. And if we start to break this stuff out, we start to think, geez, how do we draw these boundaries?
Very good. Last one. Detroit Public Schools is $400 million in the hole and is watching its enrollment decline precipitously. If it dips below 100,000 students, Michigan law will allow new charter schools to open in the Motor City. But the school board thinks more competition will financially cripple the district and should be halted. Is protectionism what Detroit needs?
No, it is not. So this is a really fascinating story. First of all, I love it that the state legislature in Michigan was clearly trying to protect Detroit from competition from new charter schools. So they write into the law that, quote, Class A districts are immune from new charter competition, and define Class A as those bigger than 100,000. Well, of course, at the time, Detroit was the only district in the state bigger than 100,000. It's like when Illinois legislators talk about the, you know, districts bigger than 200,000 and are referring to Chicago. Well, lo and behold, Detroit loses a bunch of population, and now it's going to dip below 100,000, which could mean that, hey, all of a sudden it's open for business for charter schools again. I think that's actually a good thing. The system's in disarray, and certainly high-quality charter schools could do kids in Detroit a lot of good.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, from where I stand, and I think both of us, it's certainly a given. The danger, of course, is that we immediately get into this business where the advocates are going to oversell charter schooling, are going to overpromise, mm-hmm. or we're going to have, you know, the rose-tinted glasses on. Washington, D.C. has lost a third of its students to charter schools. Vast promises were made 10 years, 12 years ago about how this would revolutionize D.C. We have massively uneven quality in the D.C. charter sector, and it's a hard pitch to argue that this has led to any obvious improvement or efficiency in the DCPS.
Well, that's true. But I think it's clear to say that the best public schools in DC right now are charter schools. And there are several of them that you could name serving thousands of kids. So, I mean, it's still been a positive development on the whole. I mean, you know, Detroit, what Michigan could do is look to what Ohio has done, where, of course, Fordham does a lot of work. That said, okay, if you're going to have a new charter school, it's got to be run by an organization with a track record of success with charter schools. That means the KIPPS. That means the Achievement First. You know, if they don't want to open the market up wide in Detroit, perhaps they could at least say you've got to have some evidence that you've done this well.
That's elsewhere. Right. I mean, that's certainly, you know, one real sensible way to go. The larger lesson here is just that, you know, for those of us who think it's a good thing that you're going to be able to open charters in Detroit, not to think that's the end of the battle, but that's the starting line. The yeah. question is, how do you make sure that these are good schools and how can you support them?
Okay, that's all the time we have from Pardon the Gadfly. Now it is time for Jeff Cooner to tell us about the education outrage of the week. Jeff, let's see. This is your second to last education outrage of the week. You're going to be starting in July your campaign to become the next Rush Limbaugh. How does that feel? Your days at Fordham are waning.
Mike, it's heartbreaking. It's depressing. It's my penultimate education outrage. And I mean, the last one is going to be really special, but you know, as all the listeners out there know, I am from Canada, so I want to make this one about the Great White North. As you know, I think Canadians are thinner, more educated. On the whole, I think better people than Americans. But not everything is perfect up there in Canada. There is a story in today's Toronto Sun by a Raymond.
Thinner?
Pardon me?
You think they're thinner?
Canadians?
Oh, we had a debate about this.
Canadians are definitely thinner. There's no contest.
Really?
Maybe in Montreal.
You know, I mean, Canadians don't eat as much junk food. They don't supersize everything.
See, what are your data on this? Is this what your sources are telling you?
Just from my own eyes.
But you grew up in Montreal, which is probably quite influenced by the French culture, which is, you know, much thinner.
Well, it's more sex obsessed.
In the heartland of Canada, that there's probably plenty of.
Well, I mean, I've been to Toronto, and I got to tell you, people in Toronto are a hell of a lot thinner than people in New York or Washington. That's for sure. I'm serious. The portion sizes in restaurants in this country are, to me, stunning. When my wife and I go out to eat, we just order. Literally, it's one plate. We'll just split it up two ways. Sorry, we're from Canada. We don't gorge at the trough. Not everything is a perpetual buffet.
I mean, Cooter, this is spoken by a man who, let's face it, was what a good 30 pounds heavier when you joined the Fordham Foundation staff. Isn't that right?
No, and I still seriously. I mean, this whole media thing, honestly, is going to kill me. They want me to lose about 40, 50 pounds for the media room. I mean, they're insane, man. I mean, I'm seriously, I am dieting. I'm living on cottage cheese and blueberries right now.
Wait, you're going to be a talk radio host?
Well, they also want me to do some TV in the media room at the Washington Times. And, you know, they even tell me to my face, they go, you're too fat. That's what they say. They don't say like, you know, you need to lose. They go, you're too fat, Cooner. You know, shed 40 to 50 pounds. I mean, that's insane.
And I just want to point out that we would never say something like that at the Fordham Foundation. We accepted you as you were.
No, that's what I mean. That's one of the reasons why I'm really going to miss you guys.
All right. So what's happening and what's the problem with Canada?
Well, wait a minute. Now that you're thin, you don't really need their friendship, right? You're good.
Honestly, Mike, I'm aiming to be a spokesman for Weight Watchers eventually. Seriously. You know, this was me, you know, before I got into, you know, Weight Watchers diet.
Did you save your pants?
I got bigger ones at home, but yeah, I want to save my pants.
You got to save the old pants so that you can hold them up.
Well, exactly. You hold them up and you see all the space in between. Yeah. You know?
All right. Canada. Canada. What's happening in Canada?
Yeah. So what's happening in Canada is this, Mike, literally, this is stunning. And it's in today's Toronto Sun, Wednesday, June 18th, because people aren't going to believe this. So they're going to think Jeff Cooner is making this up. I could not make this up. A woman by the name of Colleen Leduc, which is a great Canadian name, half English, half French. God bless her. Colleen Leduc has an 11-year-old autistic girl by the name of Victoria, probably named after Queen Victoria, but let that go. This poor girl is 11 years old. She's autistic. She's nonverbal. She's severely autistic. She goes to Terry Fox Elementary School in Toronto. Colleen picks up her daughter, takes her home. She gets a message, a voicemail, urgently telling her she has to return to school with her daughter. There's a major crisis, but they don't say what it is. Poor Colleen, or Miss Leduc, is so taken aback, she goes back to Terry Fox Elementary School. She's thinking, what's going on? What's going on? The teacher is there. The vice principal is there. The principal is there. They tell her that poor little Victoria's educational assistant, I swear to you, consulted a psychic, and when consulting the psychic said that a youngster whose name begins with the letter V is being sexually abused by somebody between the ages of 23 and 26. So her educational assistant was saying, who do I have in my class that starts with the letter V? I swear to you, she goes, it's Victoria. And because of this, they called in the Children's Aid Society, which is a government body, to investigate cases of child abuse. So the poor family literally now is being investigated by the provincial government in Ontario for abusing their daughter because the educational assistant went to see a psychic. Now, Mike, this is mind-boggling. This brings stupidity to a whole new level. They call me Mr. Pink Slip. Let me start handing them out, all right? The principal, Brian Tremaine, who was the one that told her that the Children's Aid Society were going to investigate this, he's got to go.
Yep.
Okay,
yep,
he's the first one to go. The educational assistant who went to see the psychic. If you have somebody teaching children who are going to see psychics and taking psychics seriously, I don't care how many ed degrees they have. Gone. Fired. All right. So I would get rid of these two and then maybe look at the school board in general. That's my education outrage of the week, Mike.
Thank you, Jeff Cooner, with the education outrage of the week. Wow. I mean, some people probably argue that, that believing in psychics is somewhat related to religious beliefs, and therefore you couldn't fire somebody based on that.
You know what I'm thinking of is I'm remembering in Ghost when I guess it was Patrick Swayze had died and was trying to communicate with Whoopi Goldberg, and nobody believed. Right? The whole problem was he was trying to get the word to Demi Moore about the murderers, right? And nobody was believing it.
Yeah.
So all I'm thinking is, well, mm-hmm. I'm more or less in sympathy with Jeff on this. What if we're not giving the psychic due credit?
Yeah.
What if the child is actually being assaulted?
Exactly.
And we're laughing.
And the educational consultant, our assistant, I mean, you know, she feels like, oh my God, what if I don't say anything and something terrible happens to this girl?
I just remember how frustrated I felt for Whoopi Goldberg during that movie.
Yeah.
I was like, why aren't people listening to you?
Well, and
why aren't people believing Swayze?
Sure. We all felt that frustration.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, if that was outrageous, it was a little weird, but that wasn't the education...
News of the Weird.
News of the Weird, no. Thank you, Greg. But it is that time that we wait for all week long, Education News of the Weird time. With our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, what's weird this week?
Mike, according to the Wall Street Journal, Britain, the land of school uniforms, rigorous exams, ivy-colored school halls, etc., is embracing an American invasion, the high school prom. British teenagers say they've seen the events in movies like American Pie and television shows such as The OC, and they want the chance to dress up and rent limousines themselves. That means a new reason for Britons to worry about the dilution of their culture, a new burden on parents' pocketbooks, and new businesses selling prom essentials such as tuxedos and corsages. Quote, "It's getting more and more elaborate," unquote, says Keith Ryder, who manages a banquet hall here, here being Britain, that many schools hire for the big dance. Quote, "I'm 40, and we never had anything like this when we left school," unquote. But some schools aren't going for proms. Instead, at Harrow School, founded in 1572, graduating boys have a black tie leavers feast with their parents in the school dining hall. The evening ends with a sing-along of songs like Ducker and 40 Years On in the boys' boarding houses. But at other institutions, bright yellow Lamborghinis and tiaras are the rule. That's Education News of the Weird.
You know, Rick, you may not know this, but Liam Julian is the Hoover Institution's leading authority on the British education system. It's true. You can check this out on the on hoover.org and look for Liam's bio up there. And Liam, he's thinking about writing a book. You want to tell Rick what that book's about?
Oh, all about British school secretary Ed Balls. Yes. Sort of like a biography. It could be called Balls, you know, the life and times of Ed Balls. But Balls would be prominent in the title of the book.
I can appreciate that.
Yeah. All right, Rick, so I got to ask, did you go to prom?
Yes.
Oh, good. With a date?
Yes.
Okay.
Good. We went to, remember we went for Greek belly dancing first,
mm-hmm.
and we went in my old duster, and it was the whole thing. Yeah.
Greek belly dancing?
Yeah. She was a pretty funky chick.
The belly dancer or your date?
Both, actually, come to think of it.
Wow. Okay.
Who'd you take to prom?
Well, I took Bonnie Halls. Bonnie, my high school sweetheart.
Your sweetie, yes. And Liam, who'd you take?
A variety of people. To different proms. Not to the same.
I was going
to
say. Liam just packed the back of that limo. He said, I'm taking six girls. It's going to be like one of those teen movies.
All right. Well, I think with that, we better wrap it up. But next week, it's a very special podcast next week. Jeff Kooner's last podcast here. So everybody make sure to tune in. Until then.
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.